Okay, thank you very much for giving up your lunch out of this. I'm going to give you one chapter of the book that's in place with OUP at the moment, but in a more concentrated form for a talk. The book is a taxonomic account of the defences that have been most popular, most influential, as Marcella said just then, over the 19th and 20th centuries. There is one important thing I need to key you into before I start. This is not polemic. I'm terrible at polemic. I have a kind of constitutional aversion to it. I tend to think we argue badly, though sometimes we argue necessarily when we do polemic. This argument that I'm dealing with today, the democracy needs us argument for the humanities, or what I would call the gadfly argument for the humanities, has been, it seems to me, the most strongly felt, the most strongly identified with, especially in America. It has also been, it seems to me, the least tested, and there's an oddity about that, because the basis of the argument, as you're probably already aware, is that what the democracy needs and what the humanities best train people in is a culture of reasoned argument, of kind of skeptical, Socratic debate about ideas. This one argument, therefore, it seems to me, curiously, has been the least tested. So what I want to do is, as I say, not polemic, but to try to give the argument a hard time and see what emerges as a result. So insofar as the humanities possess a strong piety about their own value at present, it seems to me the piety that they, of all the faculties of the university, are a force for the democracy. So strong has been the commitment to this terrain of advocacy in recent years in the UK and for much longer in the American liberal arts system that it does seem necessary to approach this of all claims with a degree of scepticism. So let me give you the contrarian literary critic's way into the argument. Rex Warner's 1938 novel, The Professor. Warner's hero is a distinguished classicist at an unnamed university in a minor European state, loosely modelled on Austria between 1932 and 38. The greatest living authority on Sophocles, rich in a culture of many languages and times, he finds himself called upon to lead the nation at a moment of crisis when the imminent possibility of fascist takeover by a neighbouring country threatens the future of his country's democracy. Though he's an eloquent exponent of the history and philosophical ethos of a democratic polity, he proves for his own time inapt. His conception of the ancient Greek polis as the first safety zone for a liberal organisation of citizens against the barbarism of others fails to connect with the seriousness of his democracy's predicament. There is, his son remonstrates with him publicly, he's much more politically active, less stopping to reason, son. There is no enclosed space in Europe. The enemies of democracy are in control of our democracies. The professor lasts 2 days in power before being forced to flee from office when his chief of police conducts a coup on behalf of the fascists. In a symbolic assault on the liberal educational aspirations to which he has dedicated his life, he must watch from the shadows of the university quadrangle while some of the students throw his favourite books, his library, in effect, on the fire. "What do you say then, boys?" shouts the student leader. "Shall we bung Keats in with the rest? Of course I shall abide by your democratic decision. Bung it in and damn democracy," they reply. The novel is such scenes notwithstanding something other than didactic allegory in its refusal fully to undermine the professor's idealism, its evident intellectual commitment to his culture of philosophic debate, scholarly preservation of knowledge, and aesthetic judgment, even as it depicts his unfitness to lead the democracy in wartime. It speaks at once for and against the importance of the humanities as the cultural bedrock of a democratic polity. The professor has never, as far as I can see, it's hardly surprising, made it onto any of the great books lists associated with American liberal arts teaching, though Warner's 1944 translation of Medea has. Depicting a moment of crisis at which the democratic culture is put in suspension by the exigencies of fighting fascism, it's not a comfortable fit with the work of sustaining and enhancing a democratic culture that has been the purpose of liberal arts curricula past and present. In key respects, it's hardly a fair test of the educational values it defends and mourns. Excuse me. Whoops, sorry, one second. The movement of the humanities professor from his role as critic of government to governor is, by the novels and his own lights, a mistake. It's unsurprising that a man who spent his life in scholarship should prove a poor political leader. Nor is there any real difficulty with the thought that democratic values need to be backed up by strong armies. The Athenians would have agreed. Nevertheless, in asking so explicitly what are the limits of the humanities' democratic influence, the professor can serve as a skeptic's opening on the most ambitious argument for the public value of the humanities now regularly heard in America and Britain, and what is for quite different reasons widely seen as a moment of crisis for liberal education. I guess you're becoming worried if you make it explicit. I'm not planning to demolish the argument here. What I want to see is what happens if you treat it with skepticism rather than the usual free ride. Well, it seems to me the usual free ride. Martha Nussbaum's not-for-profit 2010 is the most high profile of several efforts in recent years to persuade governments and publics historically committed to liberal educational ideals that a good reason, even the primary one, for preserving that commitment is that a healthy democracy rests on it. Her manifesto is an eloquent restatement of the founding principles of the American liberal arts system. But if her main claims wouldn't have been alien to the deans and professors who promoted liberal arts curricula in the aftermath of Rex Warner's coming war, the air of beleagueredness might have surprised them. This is Nussbaum. Thirsty for national profit, nations and their systems of education are heedlessly discarding skills that are needed to keep democracies alive. If this trend continues, nations all over the world will soon be producing generations of useful machines, rather than complete citizens who can think for themselves, criticize tradition, and understand the significance of another person's sufferings and achievements. It's no accident that this, the most polemical form of the democracy needs us argument, is also the most defensive one. Not-for-profit is an urgent appeal to university leaders and the wider public for a renewed commitment to the liberal arts across the American secondary and tertiary education systems, at a time when that commitment's under pressure from falling enrollments, cuts in budgets, prioritization of useful skills over humanistic studies, and increasingly corporatist university administrations. In other words, the perceived enemy of democracy today is not an alternative political system such as fascism, but the effect of a global capitalist system that ignores or discounts reasoned debate about the aims and ideals of the polis in favor of market forces. What does it mean to write a manifesto for a kind of education system that already exists? Or does Nussbaum believe that the liberal arts model has, like some political theories one can think of, never been fully tested? Certainly her idea of a fully liberalized education from primary to tertiary level that would ensure the health of the democracy involves a more strenuous mission statement than any institution has yet to put its name to. She has a 7-point plan, that's 2 up on Dewey, for educating the emotions, and thereby yielding better, more tolerant, more responsible citizens who will be skilled in critical thinking, courageous in dissent, willing and able to argue free of the constraints of deference or the assumptions of authority. She bases that plan in part on a theory of healthy moral development in childhood as involving positional thinking about the perspectives of others, learning empathy, controlling aggression, rejecting those pernicious adult or norms that might impede open-mindedness, compassion, reciprocity. From this model of early education, she extrapolates many of her claims for what a higher education should do, though it's not entirely clear why a higher education should be considered a necessity in the same terms that a primary and secondary education may be. Some lines of skepticism do get a hearing, but the answers move fairly quickly past potential difficulties. Nussbaum again. Responsible citizenship requires the ability to assess historical evidence, to use and think critically about economic principles, to assess accounts of social justice, to speak a foreign language, to appreciate the complexities of the major world religions. The factual part alone could be done without the skills and techniques we've come to associate with the humanities, but a catalogue of facts without the ability to assess them or understand how a narrative is assembled from evidence is almost as bad as ignorance, since the pupil will not be able to distinguish ignorant stereotypes purveyed by politicians and cultural leaders from the truth or bogus claims from valid ones. World history and economic understanding then must be humanistic and critical if they are to be at all useful in forming intelligent global citizens, and so forth. This is prose powered by imperatives, requires, must, and by moral plain speaking, good, bad, true, bogus. It is, in other words, a strikingly unsocratic defense of a Socratic education, though that may be a sacrifice mandated by the genre of the manifesto. More problematically, it's an argument that moves fairly deftly to align humanistic and critical, so that economics and law, for example, become honorary branches of the humanities as soon as they start scrutinizing their own knowledge claims. The reference to skills and techniques we have come to associate with the humanities, however, indicates at least gesturally that we may be in the terrain Andrew Abbott describes in Chaos of Disciplines, whereby a field is pressed to show its more aggressive edge in response to relative neglect of its skills and techniques elsewhere, in other words, in this case, in other departments of the university or elsewhere in public life. What currently looks humanistic about certain kinds of education, then, is so not by virtue of the humanities' definitive ownership of historical argument or comparative cultural understanding or philosophical skepticism, but because such intellectual and, for Nussbaum, ethical practices seem now underrepresented and underregarded in disciplines, even in whole faculties where they once had a prominent place. So most pertinently, I think we're fingering the social sciences and the political sciences here. In the main, Nussbaum's case rests on her view of the humanities as having a much longer historical and political importance than would be explained by such relatively recent changes in the character of our disciplines, however. The roots of her defence lie not just generally with the Socratic mode of argument, but specifically in Plato's account of the true philosopher's role within the political state. In Benjamin Jowett's translation of the famous passage from the Apology, "And now, Athenians, I'm not going to argue for my own sake as you may think for yours, but for yours. For if you kill me, you will not easily find another like me, who, if I may use such a ludicrous figure of speech, am a sort of gadfly, rupostinos, given to the state, polis, by the god, and the state is like a great and noble steed who is tardy in his motions owing to his very size and requires to be stirred into life. I am that gadfly which God has given the state, and all day long and in all places am always fastening upon you, arousing and persuading and reproaching you. And as you will not easily find another like me, I would advise you to spare me." A literal translation of the central metaphor would be a sort of gadfly or spur, mupos puns on spur and gadfly, given to the city, polis. Jowett renders polis imperfectly but conventionally enough as state. Nussbaum substitutes another Greek word, demokratia. As she sees it, I am a sort of gadfly given to the democracy by the gods. Attention to the figure of the gadfly is, in justice to Nussbaum, not much more than a passing note in her discussion, something beyond a grace note, but rather less than a major theme. The main emphasis is on the wider Socratic inheritance, conditioning the humanities' sense of their own vocational and social function. On the other hand, it's worth considering the effect of this small slight of the translating hand. Making the substitution of the democracy for the polis, not found in any standard translation, clearly assists Nussbaum's case for the importance of Socratic pedagogy to a democratic political culture. She goes on to chart a genealogy of educational reformers in his long wake, from Rousseau through to John Dewey in America and Rabindranath Tagore in India. But reaccenting Plato's terms also enables her to cast into relative shadow aspects of the Socratic model that do not as easily recommend themselves to modern democratic theory and practice. It's necessary to step back at this point in order to gauge what's non-conventional about Nussbaum's argument for all its continuities with standard liberal arts claims about education helping to cultivate informed civic consciousness. The classical claim for the political value of education, long predating the more specific aspirations of a liberal education, was that it functions as a cultural qualification for the exercise of political and administrative power. I'm quoting Ian Hunter. More important than any practical considerations of training here is the idea that education may instill what Hunter calls a common set of discursive and moral reflexes. That claim makes no particular assumptions about knowledge content, or predating such disciplinary divisions, about the value of the humanities compared with law or politics or economics as core elements of the curriculum. Though most of the models derived from antiquity reserve a prominent place for rhetoric as the art of political persuasion. This view is in its essentials fairly bland. It makes few assumptions about the kind of polity involved. Unless one invokes the extreme case of tyranny, no kind of government will prosper better with ignorant leaders or administrators than it will from having at its disposal intelligent and informed individuals. Oligarchy, aristocracy, even one-party dictatorship require in that broad outlook educated members. They will differ crucially from democracy, of course, in how far they wish to extend the goods of education to the populations concerned, and how far they attempt to use education as a means of ideological control, that is, how far they encourage independent critical thought. But all of them will hold in some measure that education is a desirable qualification for the exercise of political and administrative power. The distinctive claim made by advocates of an education in and for democracy is that because in a democracy it is the people who govern, the people must be equipped by education to govern well. It's not a coincidence that extension of the franchise in Britain and America over the 19th and early 20th centuries ran in tandem with extension of the right to a free state education. That democracy might benefit from the general educational provision associated with liberal arts curricula has been an important claim, especially in America from the 1940s. That democracy has any specific need of the humanities is a much less common assertion, despite its superficial similarity to other statements sometimes yoked to the humanities' defence, including Derrida's "No democracy without literature, no literature without democracy." claim that beyond all this, democracy has any specific need of a higher education in the humanities is still less conventional. It presents an immediate problem of access, one highly politicised in its own right. The most ambitious target for participation in tertiary education in the UK has been 50% of 18 to 30-year-olds, the highest achieved figure to date, 43%. I can't get an exact comparison with US statistics, but if you use the US Census Bureau, it shows that 50.1% of 20 to 21-year-olds attend undergraduate or graduate college at the moment. Of the total enrolment in both countries, a diminishing percentage majors in the humanities, currently just over 15% in the UK, just under 16% in the US, with the important difference that US liberal arts curricula give students across a range of subjects access to some component of humanities education. Now, one of the things that makes, I think, the argument about the humanities harder to prosecute in some ways is that for us it is less well-defined by the models of liberal education and the other kinds of argument for the humanities that have emerged out of a liberal tradition, but that also, I think, perhaps makes it fresher and more pertinent to us. Insofar as any of the major British advocates for liberal education in the 19th century tied it to the good functioning of democracy, they saw education as a means of easing and controlling the transition towards democracy. The incompleteness of franchise reform even at the end of the Victorian period is less germane here than the distinction each of the major public moralists made, quite independent of their support or otherwise, for reforms of the ballot, between equality of representation and, as they saw it, the necessary superiority of intellect, character, and education desirable in the people's representatives and those involved in the administration of the state's affairs. As Mill put it in Considerations on Representative Government, 1861, and I'm selecting him because he is in most respects the most obviously egalitarian of the major Victorian thinkers in his views on democratic representation. As he put it, the natural tendency of representative government as of modern civilization is towards collective mediocrity, and this tendency is increased by all reductions and extensions of the franchise, their effect being to place the principal power in the hands of classes more and more below the highest level of instruction in the community. But though the superior intellects and characters will necessarily be outnumbered, it makes a great difference whether or not they are heard. In the false democracy, which instead of giving representation to all, gives it only to the local majorities, the voice of the instructed minority may have no organs at all in the representative body. Most Victorian reservations about the democratic purposes of education are no longer relevant considerations in the debate today about the contribution of the humanities to democracy. They're of interest to me at least primarily because they reveal the historically recent arrival of the democratic claim in the debate, the extent to which we are even now arguing on new terrain. In one respect, however, the questions they raise about the relation of education to the good running of government identify a problem still to be reckoned with. There's a familiar objection to views of the kind Mill expresses that afford a privileged political place to the instructed few. To prefer, as he would have preferred, the principal power to be in the hands of those classes who've received the highest level of instruction in the community is to support a guardianship model of democracy about which presumably most of us have proper doubts. The exacting educational requirements set out for rulers in Plato's Republic most obviously are key to defining a version of democracy that would exclude much the larger part of the demos from power. Opponents of guardianship democracy standardly argue that in requiring a level of education for its representatives above the ordinary provision for citizens, the guardianship model sets the bar for entry too high. If democracy is to retain its founding connection with a belief in political equality, that argument has to be clinching. Yet the political theorist Robert Dahl, famously sceptical of guardianship democracy, thinks many educated people will instinctively try to wriggle out of it. He asks us to imagine a debate between the representative of the demos and the representative of the aristoi. Aristos defends guardianship via an appeal to the collective wisdom of modern philosophers of democracy, Mill prominent among them. You, demos, she says, really do agree with me that the process of governing the state ought to be restricted to those who are qualified to govern. I know most Democrats recoil from such an idea. You fear that by openly admitting this assumption, you'll give the game away at the start to those of us who support guardianship. Certainly in your democratic theory, philosophy, and argument, this dangerous premise is rarely made explicit, precisely because it is so dangerous to your cause. Yet I don't believe that any important political philosopher in the democratic tradition, Locke, Rousseau, Jeremy Bentham, James Mill, for example, has ever rejected it, though perhaps only John Stuart Mill made it fully explicit. End quote. But such a political arrangement would in truth be not democracy but hierarchy, so the imagined post from Demos then goes, nor will the critic of guardianship easily be appeased by the response Mill would have made, that if privileged access to education by class is removed from the picture, we're then dealing acceptably with meritocracy, not guardianship. Does not education, as Bourdieu and others have told us, too commonly conceal the reproduction of social class with an illusion of democratic openness? Outside the parameters of Rex Warner's novel, no one's suggesting that the principal power in the democracy should lie with the humanities departments of universities and those they educate. Nevertheless, a suspicion that the guardianship model haunts the democracy needs this argument would be consistent both with Plato and with a long line of adherence to the gadfly model after him. Neither Plato nor Socrates, as the apology above all ought to remind us, was an admirer of democracy, however tempered their views by recognition that the restored Athenian democracy from 403 CBE was stable and without obviously feasible alternatives. If the Socratic gadfly is famously the irritant conscience of the state, it's by no means clear that his role is particular to democracy, since, as I said, his function would be as valid under oligarchy or indeed under any political system, with the possible exceptions of dictatorship and theocracy, which may be why Socrates does not specify to the king Archon's court and its jurors the kind of polis on which the philosopher acts by divine license. Nor is it at all clear that his role is distinctively aligned with the humanities, given the pre-disciplinary articulation of a Socratic method that has bearing on all aspects of intellectual, social, and political life. In terms of content, the Socratic dialogues belong in modern politics, social science, law, and theology, at least as clearly as they belong to the humanities. The Socratic gadfly is the form of Julien Mondat's intellectual speaking truth to power, of Karl Mannheim's ideal intelligentsia charged with correcting the narrowly class and party-bound interests of the rest of society, and of many other romanticising accounts of the intellectual as a quasi-external authority on the structure and operations of political life. And with Mondat in mind, one could outline a less flattering genealogical account of the humanities' relationship to democratic ideals than Nussbaum provides. Such an account might follow the lines indicated in Francis Malherne's Culture, Metaculture, from Thomas Mann's Reflections on an Unpolitical Man, through Bondin's La Trahison des Clercs, Mannheim's Ideology and Utopia, or Taker's The Revolt of the Masses, to Leavis's Mass Civilization and Minority Culture. The story then would be much more in line with Socrates' reluctant assent to democracy, though revised as the story of a specialist cadre, or to use Coleridge's preferred medievalism, a clerisy, rather than an exceptional individual not easily replaced. The philosopher-critic is imagined, in Mulhern's words, supervening over the political space from a higher plane of social judgment, rather than involved in its deliberations on terms of equality of status. Unless anyone assumed that the higher plane assumption is self-evidently self-discrediting, or that the changes in the understanding of culture from Raymond Williams onwards have rendered the idea of clerisy obsolete, it's worth observing that it has prominent advocates even now, most explicitly in Britain, Jonathan Bate, who has repeatedly defended the humanising work of universities by appealing to the Coleridgean view, combining it with more modern claims for the humanities' contribution to the knowledge economy and improving global security. None of this means that there is no way of adapting or modernising the Socratic role so that it does relate a higher education in the humanities to democracy without smuggling in an assumption of guardianship. But it leaves us quite a lot of work to do in the way of adaptation and modernisation. Collectively, we cannot all be gadflies, Annette Bayer has warned, or we run the risk of being no better than a plague. Why, in Richard Rorty's approving gloss, should the rest of society then not merely tolerate but subsidise our activity? There's an obvious opening here to counter that bent of the metaphor with Hart and Napier's conception of the global democratic multitudinal swarm. It was noticeable when the UK papers and media sites were reporting on the student protests in 2010 that they had very frequent recourse to metaphors of a swarm and a multitude. We don't have to endorse Hart and Napier's inebriate vision of power through political faith, I'm quoting Tom Mann, approvingly, to claim contra bear that the humanities might be, as it were, a large collective gadfly, for example, by reminding present-day society of inconvenient but pertinent facts about its past and its cultural heritage. This sounds more promising. But again, it's not self-evident that the humanities have special rights or responsibilities here over disciplines with more obvious claims to understanding the operations of modern government and modern economies. The potential redundancy of criticism that Bayer and Rorty fear can be discounted, I think. Why place limits on the amount of critical self-scrutiny that a democracy can bear? A more legitimate difficulty with the plague of modern Socratic gadflies operating out of our universities involves the stark conflict between the isolated adjutant role of the Socratic philosopher and the institutionalized and professionalized function of the modern academic. If we want nearer models for the kind of professional, scholarly, and structuredly educational work we do, Bruce Robbins has suggested, we might have to start by rethinking the Socratic animus towards rhetoric and sophistry. We also need a sharper account of how the anti-authoritarian attitudes of Socrates can yield a model of critical inquiry that is a social practice, rather than, as Macaulay jadedly saw it, the charismatic performance of one man with a thorough love for making other men look small. More immediately, since we don't lack, I think, good accounts of the social and political responsibilities of our profession, I'm thinking of John Guillory, Bruce Robbins, people that are not surprisingly, I think most of them have come out of America so far. We need an account of our characteristic intellectual objects and activities that more accurately allows us to identify our role in relationship to the democracy. As classically imagined, the gadfly figure makes us both anti-authoritarian and anti-statist in a way that doesn't help us to that end. Nor does it enable us to articulate why the humanities might be particularly well equipped to meet certain of the democracy's current needs. Justification by way of cultural distinctions between intellectual disciplines quickly leads, as the history of two and three cultures debates might warn us, to misdescription. A draft version of this lecture, for which I retain some affection and conviction, pursues the claim that the humanities have a particular gadfly role to play as a corrective to the dominance of quantitative modes of reasoning in public political life. For example, if we believe that the sheer quantity of information gathering and information provision that attends government is inimical to coherent debate about policy, we might claim that it's within the remit of the humanities to show where the democratic interest in open government may be misdirected into obfuscatory proceduralism, or where supposed devolution of power to the people in what Britain's Prime Minister was, at least for a while, fond of calling a post-bureaucratic age, can misrepresent a dismantling of the state, or where the economistic assumptions at work in the audit culture that shapes not just our universities but all our professions and public services start damaging public values by translating them into the language and values of demonstrable public impact, or indeed by making the work of assessment so time-consuming that the cost of accounting to government almost outweighs the value of the public money is brought in. The draft pages, as you can see, this is the page under erasure, the draft pages also perceive the suggestion of one sympathetically inclined UK economist, that's Hamish McRae, that it's surely within the remit of the humanities to remind our colleagues in the social sciences that econometricians ignorant of history are liable to make serious political and economic errors. Some or all of these suggestions are indeed opportunities for the humanities to serve the public good, but it's insufficiently clear to me, at least, that the democracy needs the humanities specifically to do the job. Most of the needs they identify are needs any critically educated member or group of the democracy could respond to intelligently, whatever their educational specialisation. And clearly part of what I'm tackling here, though it's more specifically the remit of an earlier part of the book, is the problem of translating a liberal arts education agenda or defence through to a system in which, in the main, our educational procedures are very much more specialised from very early on. If secondary education has been broad and included enough of the skills being associated here with the humanities, but not solely theirs, then is there really a case for the special democratic force of a humanities higher education? In one of these instances, the need for a higher education in a humanities discipline is clear. A secondary education in history some years back will probably not have imparted the knowledge necessary to identify the relevant historical ignorance in economic theory today. But the more general protections of democracy look rather less obviously in need of higher humanities training. Moreover, if supplying a lack or remedying a failure in the governments of the democracy is presented as the humanities' primary justification of ourselves, it heavily skews what we do in one direction, aligning us with political work that's unquestionably important, but not obviously exclusively or even distinctively ours to do and likely to be done better by others. The us is a problem. Democracy needs us. The first person plural is the regularly preferred point of view for much writing about the academic profession, for the academic profession. It's a rhetorical sleight of hand by which the concerns of the profession can be made to seem entirely congruent with those of the democratic polity as a whole. But the profession isn't the representative body of the democracy, and quite who's included as the agents of the humanities claim to be a bulwark of democracy is very often unclear. If the us in democracy needs us is taken to refer to those of us who are scholars or students of the humanities in the universities, it does seem to commit us, willingly or not, to a guardianship model of democracy. rational coherence requires us then to accept, however reluctantly, that Plato and Mill were right, and that democracy left to itself is a noble but sluggish beast in need of our goading. But if the us is a bid for all members of the democracy to protect the good operation of the democracy by exercising our critical capacities, humanities departments will be one place among many nurturing those abilities. The humanities academic, much as he or she can claim expertise in critical thinking, will have no special, no additional authority in the political domain above that of ordinary citizens. If the distinction between the higher level practice of the professional few and the sufficiently educated practice of the many goes unmade, humanities scholars risk falling into the error Ian Hunter identifies when he warns against mistaking the prestigious ethical comportment available within the university to literary theorists, he was writing a few years ago now, more broadly cultural critics, with our role as citizens. They also risk confusing the kinds of critical capacity that it's desirable a democracy should have available within it with the critical capacities requisite for its survival or for individual participation in it. This doesn't mean that the work of humanities departments shouldn't be political or that it cannot seek to change actual social and cultural life, as Louis Menand puts it. It certainly doesn't mean that their scholars have no responsibilities as members of a profession to the ideal of democratic equality, or more particularly that their work shouldn't recognise and respond to the serious imperfections in that ideal as witnessed in today's actual social and cultural arrangements. Nor does it mean that fidelity to democratic ideals shouldn't be part of the university's professional discourses of legitimation. But the ideals that characterise humanities scholars' professional life and work are not the same thing as the discipline's justification for being, or in a more specific UK context, its justification for being in receipt of public funds. The most persuasive effort to date to make the case for the democratic force of the humanities in the UK, keeping in view that distinction between the academy as the home of expert practice and the academy as the place that nurtures skills widely practiced beyond it, seems to me to be Francis Mulhern's paper for a one-day conference at Birkbeck College, London, entitled Why Humanities? It's available as a podcast for anybody who wasn't there. Justine is the majority. One of the strengths of Mulhern's position is that he recognises the degree of under-definition in any appeal to the humanities' democratic commitments as evidence of their contribution to the common good. People who seek to defend the work of humanities departments, he observes, regularly invoke their ability to foster skills and values that are essential to a democratic society. In doing so, they've tended to align themselves with an obviously desirable ethical comportment on the part of individuals and institutions in a way that confers easy benefit, one might add easy esteem, on the speaker or institution, but does little to identify the current needs of the democracy. So, I'm quoting, something akin to democracy turns up under the heading of equality of opportunity, end of quote, in recent British accounts of humanities education, Mulhern observes, but this quickly becomes an economic good. Something else akin to democracy, quote, turns up under the heading of tolerance and quickly becomes a cultural good, a putative British identity. And this is Mulhern more sustainedly. What is far less in evidence is any conviction about the demands of a properly functioning democracy. The culture of democratic practices by which, in however limited a sense, the population is said to govern itself. A democracy is a form of polity in which alternatives are conceived and propagated, interpreted and evaluated in open debate, then decided on directly or according to various norms of representation. One in which this central deliberative process is embedded in a wider culture of free investigation, criticism and advocacy, with a media appropriately organised and supported. One in which the general culture supports an open play of suggesting, imagining and evaluating the possibilities of the common life. End of quote. The argument for the humanities' contribution to democracy is not, as Mulhern expresses it, a definitional defence, and doesn't seek to be one. It puts democracy first, and the contribution of the humanities second. It's the product of a particularly bleak moment in the recent history of higher education in the UK, at which some humanities departments had recently faced closure. Many were and are seeing their work distorted by administrative efforts to maximise government funding. And the idea that universities might have a gadfly function in relation to the governing of the polity has played no part in the governor's sense of what public funds are to be used for. In response to these deformations of the political and institutional cultures in which the humanities do their work, Mulhern selects some out of the many intellectual practices pursued by the humanities, trained deliberation, criticism, advocacy, evaluation, mediation of ideas with respect to norms of representation, and identifies them as having special importance for the good political functioning of a democracy. It locates the common ground of the humanities in their attention to critical reason. Now, just very briefly, that seems to me an interestingly wider move to make than another move that's commonly made trying to defend this ground, which is that we have a special concern with, as Bruce Watkins put it, rhetoric, or as Isabel Armstrong put it to me once with, what was her phrase, with I think something like giving people access to the language, empowerment in relation to the language. That language claim is one of many claims that has seemed to work very specifically, I think, out of English departments who have been extraordinarily in the fore of these defences, I think, both in America and in Britain. The critical reasoning defence, the common ground of the humanities being their attention to critical reason, pitches it more generally, and I think it's probably better ground on which to make an argument at the level of generalisation required for a definition, a description of the humanities. The primary complaints Mulhern makes, then, about the current state of our universities are less uttered in alarm at a world crisis in educational values than they are aimed at particular national policies that may have, do have, parallels elsewhere, but they remain specific to particular democratic structures and particular elected governments, so this is him again. One of the special frustrations of observing New Labour's adventures in university policy in the UK was the persistent confusion of the democratic demand for access with the instrumental requirement to retool the workforce and the reduction of both to an arbitrary numerical target. Another feature of the period was the currency of ignorant and offensive comments about degree programmes such as media studies. What does it say about elected politicians that they cannot take seriously the idea of investigating the cultural forms that are their own most important plane of operation? The higher level intellectual practices that are the everyday core of humanities teaching and learning are also core practices of a democratic culture, such as we supposedly have and value. If elected politicians still can't get the point, if university managements are too far advanced in their corporatist makeover to explain it to them or even get it themselves, we would at least have been enlightened as to the effective reality of their commitment to democracy. End of quote. This strikes a polemical note, especially in closing, but it's polemic qualified by an awareness of the limits of its power and its likely audience. It grants the humanities a special interest in the critical examination of the cultural forms vital to the democracy, but eschews the language of moralism in favour of the operation of critical reason. For Mulhern, the key practices involved are interpretation and evaluation, not least of the role of media in assisting any decisions about matters affecting the common life. That he avoids the more ethically laden phrase, the common good, is, I suspect, symptomatic of a care not to be seen to assert that the activities of the humanities are necessarily ethically driven or endowed with special merit, though I don't imagine he would reject the phrase, the common good. The accent here isn't on safeguarding knowledge of the historical formation of Western culture and providing a kind of cultural lingua franca, as in the liberal arts tradition, or, as it was for Nussbaum, on the moral qualities cultivated in individuals or institutions by an education in the humanities. It's much less specific than the liberal arts listing of subject-specific skills ideally nurtured within a general education, but then the British system of specialisation, as they said, doesn't in the main admit of the defence of the humanities by way of their role within a general education. Rather, Mulhern confines his attention to the humanities support for that aspect of the wider democratic culture that is encoded in the structure or form of open debate, and better summarised by the word polity than the word ethos. Mulhern foregrounds, moreover, aspects of the common pursuits of the humanities that have to do with not with new knowledge or ideas, but with ongoing and to a degree repetitive disputation in our evaluation of the forms of cultural representation. One function of scholarship in the humanities is, after all, to go over ground that generations have been over before, not only because interpretations and evaluations may change, but because it's part of the scholar's responsibility to keep reinterpreting and re-evaluating that cultural memory in the context of the now. And this will involve, as Mulhern puts it, deep and abiding conflicts of understanding and commitment that crisscross our disciplines as they do all cultural life. Mulhern seems to me the best defended articulation of the democracy argument, pitched as a general claim for higher study in humanities that we've heard to date in the British debate. It takes us beyond what has been until recently a standard complaint, often but by no means exclusively heard from the left, that we're experiencing a widespread democratic deficit, a growing gap between formal and substantive democracy that can only be filled by revitalisation of participatory democracy at the national level, and the creation and protection of political spaces that allow for genuine communication, argument, agreement across the global civil society. By itself, that last analysis hasn't been a great help to the defence of the humanities, little advance, if any, on the kind of easy claim to political kudos involved in aligning ourselves with obviously desirable aspects of democracy. Mulhern keeps the argument relatively specific, asking us to recognise the political value of a culture competent to criticise the acts of mediation through which political representation does its work, conveying the concerns of the democratic electorate to its politicians, and the actions and intentions of politicians back to the electorate more and less fully, more and less honestly. He also points us to one indicative area in which recent British governments have specifically misrepresented the nature of the democracy's interest in higher education. The egalitarian interest in access to the goods of education, not all of them instrumental goods, has repeatedly been redescribed as the narrowly instrumental goal of retooling the workforce. One can speculate that this redescription may itself have been instrumental, a way of selling enlarged access under new labour to the more grudging or anti-intellectual among taxpayers. Both points are a helpful advance in clarity for the democracy needs this argument. They remind us, if we're inclined to worry about overstating the importance of higher education, that the standards for participation in a democracy are, though within the reach of all sufficiently informed and rational citizens, preferably quite high, to be capable of propagating, interpreting, and evaluating ideas in open debate is not a small competency. Some of the reservations I raised earlier are not, for me, entirely laid to rest here. For all Mulhern's wariness about cheaply earned political prestige, this is an argument that makes the humanities look very high-minded. He presents explicitly the humanities in one version of their best, and as he puts it, it's not in the nature of the best to be the usual. As with Arnold, that appeal to the best brings an inevitable reply: who's best? There's no mention here of the more fanciful lines of inquiry and expression that can be worth trying out and sometimes letting go, or about all the work that's assiduous rather than ingenious, or playful rather than serious, though any teacher knows that one good joke can sometimes get a point across to students better than a crafted critique. And when humanities departments start to look as politically serious as this, it's worth recalling that they are centres of low satire as well as of high thought, of education remedial as well as elite. Indeed, the remedial work, teaching basic competence and coherence in expression, may be as real a contribution to a democratic culture as the higher work of criticism. Mulhern's account of us at our most politically serious may also leave me wondering still how much the humanities may distinctively claim here by way of self-justification. One straightforward defence of their position is that they preserve and continue the higher order practices that are passed on to us, onto those who will go on to teach the humanities at school level. They teach the teachers. Primary and secondary teaching are, of course, only two of the many career paths pursued by humanities graduates, who take the knowledge and practices nurtured at university into very many areas of public life, including government itself. These areas are also, however, fed from the other departments of the university, and the critical work associated here with humanities, alternatives conceived and propagated, interpreted and evaluated in open debate, then decided on directly or according to various norms of representation, is, or it should be, characteristic also of how students are educated in the sciences and social sciences. It's definitive of intellectual work per se, rather than the possession of any one domain of scholarship. Such intellectual work warrants the description humane, but is indicative of a critical cast of mind towards all cultural arrangements and expressions that should be found right across our domains of inquiry. In short, you can see I get worried every time the humanities are supposed to be doing something that the social scientists and scientists are not. Okay. Mulhern indeed accepts this. At base, he's articulating a defence not just of the humanities, but of the university as a place of enlightenment. In his account, the humanities are being practiced whenever a scientist breaks off from the routinised practice of a method and starts to ask why the method has become a default practice. This is then a kind of philosophy. And whenever a health professional working in a multicultural environment starts to ponder the authority of the dominant medical discourse, to do so is to embark on rhetoric and ethics. The humanities differ only in that they practice these kinds of dubitative and speculative thinking in concentrated form, so that their disciplines stand collectively as a specialist agency of a defining general ethos of learning and inquiry. Once again, the strength of the current political assertion that the humanities have a larger or more important claim for value here rests on the observation, which seems to be correct, but also historically and politically contingent, that has become theirs as a consequence of the downgrading of those kinds of thinking in some other areas of the university and of public life. In one of his more temperately gadfly-ish late essays, The Priority of Democracy to Philosophy, Richard Rorty asks the question, does liberal democracy need philosophical justification? His answer is that those like himself, John Rawls and John Dewey, who view the question pragmatically, quote, will say that although it may need philosophical articulation, it does not need philosophical background. On this view, the philosopher of liberal democracy may wish to develop a theory of the human self that comports with the institutions he or she admires. But such a philosopher is not thereby justifying these institutions by reference to more fundamental premises, but the reverse, he or she is putting politics first and tailoring a philosophy to suit. Fleshing out our self-image as citizens of a liberal democracy with a philosophical view of the self may well be something we want to do in addition, but this sort of philosophical fleshing out doesn't have much importance for Rorty. Whether democracy needs the humanities is not the same question, since the humanities are offering not to justify democracy, but to keep it true to principles that have long possessed strong justification, in one interpretation of Plato, to keep it in good health. But the distinction Rorty is making between philosophical work that articulates a justification for democracy and philosophical work that puts the political commitment to democracy first and fits its theories to that commitment secondarily is pertinent. Mulhern does just that. He puts the common political commitment of the citizens of democracy to their own good government first, and then asks what the humanities do that serves it. The connection between the humanities and democracy then rests not primarily on the claim that the humanities foster a distinctive knowledge content in those who study them, or even that they assist the development of particularly desirable psychological qualities, but that they teach in concentrated form the critical processes of the wider democratic polity, and in some measure they represent and model those processes. They are collectively a forum for intellectual and political argument of a high order, embedded in a wider culture that has those practices at its political core, and has historically supported their higher pursuit in the university, not least financially. Advocates for the liberal arts system would not, I assume, resist this formulation, which isn't at odds with their own traditions of defence, though it takes a different argumentative path. Not everyone who works in the humanities divisions of universities will share Mulhern's prioritisation of the political. Some will think that the case for a higher education remains unproven, that we should trust in a basic primary and secondary education to provide for the critical and evaluative capacities of ordinary citizens. Also, captiously, that we should put more trust in the various kinds of value attached to the humanities that do not require the image of the democracy, noble and sluggish or ailing, to justify them. To the counter-argument that, in Jonathan Arick's phrase, removing the democratic claim from our humanities would leave us nothing important to do, they will reply that it leaves us plenty, some of which is important, and some but not all of that primarily political, but some of which might have to be content to be unimportant, just careful or scholarly or fanciful or pleasurable, but not particularly consequential. It's worth reiterating, however, that the justification of the humanities on the grounds that they teach and practice at the highest level the intellectual skills necessary for the good working of democracy is not a definitional claim. It's a defence of their public value that works inward from the needs of the polity to the contribution the humanities can make. It assumes, as did Socrates, that democracy is strengthened by having a higher level of reasoning available within it. As Mill put it, that it makes a great difference whether or not that higher reasoning is heard, but it claims no special political authority for those who make the humanities their profession. Its advocates will undoubtedly feel impelled to articulate their political defence when that contribution is in doubt, but it does not require a state of emergency for their claim to have validity. Thank you very much.